I'd like for us to start in the book of Numbers today, Numbers chapter 5. We've been looking at a lot of things in the book of Leviticus, which is a rule book for the Levites, and we'll get back to another chapter yet in that book. But we know at some point the things that have been talked about in the book of Leviticus are put into effect within the camp of Israel. Meaning, there's going to be a bunch of people who, for at least a period of time, are going to be counted as ceremonially unclean. And they need to go through a process of becoming ceremonially clean again. Some of the groups of people who are unclean are actually removed outside the camp of Israel. You remember we've got the tabernacle of God is at the center. And then we've got the Levitical tribe, including the priestly family, that's immediately around the tabernacle fence. And then we've got the 12 tribes that are stationed around the tabernacle as well, four groups of three tribes, east, west, north, south. And then, we haven't talked about this much, but there is another group that is immediately outside on some point of the compass that are not Israelis, but who left Egypt with the Israelis. Sometimes these are referred to as the rabble or the unaffiliated peoples. They are not Israelis, but they are wanting to kind of stick with the Israelis as they are heading for Canaan, for the Promised Land. So we can almost think of them as people in the process of becoming part of the nation of Israel. But we also find out in Numbers chapter 5, somewhere out there beyond the boundaries of the official tribal camps, there is a place where the unclean people live. They have their own tents, they have their own living arrangements, but they are going to be outside the official boundaries of the tent encampment. So Numbers chapter 5 tells us about how that external encampment got started. Numbers chapter 5, verse 1. He who is spoke to Moses, saying, command the people of Israel that they put out of the camp everyone who is leprous, so everyone that has the mark of leprosy that we've talked about, or has a discharge. Now, I think that this is probably a reference to unnatural discharges, such as they've got an open wound, or they've got a wound that has pus that's seeping out of it. Something is going on that there is a discharge that's not normal. They might have a really snotty nose. They might have a really productive cough. They might have diarrhea. So people who are in that category, which we would say is basically the category being sick, they have their own place that they're going to be living in, at least temporarily, outside the encampment boundaries. It's more than likely, in our mindset, kind of a hospital setting. It's an isolation ward. And then everyone who is unclean through contact with the dead. Remember, there is a period of time after you've been in contact with a dead body that you have to stay away from other persons. And so we more than likely have the encampment outside the boundaries of the non-Israeli people that are traveling with them. We probably got another encampment that is made up of the lepers who are working on getting this mark taken care of so they can come back into the boundaries of the camp. And then we've got this group that has the discharge, something sick about them, where they are having to stay outside the encampment. And then you've got people who for a variety of reasons, perhaps because they've touched a dead body, they are temporarily unclean. So they've got temporary dwellings outside the official encampment. So hopefully you got that pictured in your mind. There's several little sub-camps around the borders of the camp. Verse 3, you shall put out both male and female, putting them outside the camp, that they may not defile their camp in the midst of which I live. So the idea is the encampment immediately around the tabernacle is supposed to be for those who are holy and clean in a ceremonial fashion. We see something similar to this that happens when the temple complex is built from the time of Solomon onward. And that is, you've got the Holy of Holies, where only the high priest is allowed to go once a year. So that's the innermost holy circle. Then you have the holy place that's in front of the Holy of Holies, where only the priests who are on duty are allowed to go. So that's next ring out on the holiness factor. Then you have the courtyard of the priests and the Levites, where they do their work immediately around the temple building. That's the next bubble out. And then you have the courtyard of Israel, where the men who are the heads of the households can come into close proximity of the worship ceremonies. And then you've got the court of women that is out in the front section of the temple, and also around the edges of the courtyard of Israel. And those are the places where the family members, who are all Israelis and who are clean ceremonially, they can come and worship in those areas. And then you've got this boundary marker. Remember, we're talking about the temple from the time of Solomon onward, but we know it really well from the New Testament period. There's this boundary marker that shows where the court of Gentiles begins and where anybody, Jew, Gentile, anyone of any type of physical situation, they might be lame, they might be blind, anyone can be in that region doing their worship. So it's kind of the last bubble where everyone is authorized. So what we're seeing in the camp of Israel being set up in Numbers chapter 5 is something similar to that. You've got the tabernacle complex, where only the priests and the Levites and the worshipers who are clean are allowed to be. Then you've got the area right around the border. That's where the workers in the tabernacle, the priests and the Levites, are allowed to be. That's where their residences are located. And then you've got the 12 tribes in a ring around the tabernacle. And only the Israelis who are ceremonially clean can stay in those tents. There's a boundary around those encampments that anyone who is unclean or not Israeli, they have to stay outside that boundary. And so that's what we've just seen described here. Verse number 5 and, verse 4. The people of Israel did so, and they put them outside the camp, as he who is said to Moses, so the people of Israel did. So this has now become the normal standard for the Israeli encampment. If you become ceremonially unclean, then you have to move out of your tent, at least temporarily, and move beyond the boundaries of the encampment. Verse 5, he who is spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the people of Israel, when a man or woman commits any of the sins that people commit by breaking faith with he who is, and that person realizes his guilt, he shall confess his sin that he's committed, and he shall make full restitution for his wrong, adding a fifth to it, and giving it to him to whom he did wrong. And we've talked about this issue already, that there was this expectation that not only should you get things right with God through the sacrifice, you needed to get things right with any person that was harmed by your action as well. And the usual damages that were added to the restitution was this fifth. It was about 20% over and above. Now, the next question comes up, though, naturally. What if the person that I wronged isn't around anymore? Maybe they died. Maybe they moved away and I've lost track of them. And so I didn't find out until just now that I did something wrong to them, and I want to make it right. Well, perhaps if they died, they've got heirs. So you could go to them and pay them back. Basically go and say, look, your dad, I ended up taking something of his that didn't belong to me, and I didn't pay him for it. And now I need to make it right as I'm trying to get things right with God. And so here is the value of the property that I shouldn't have had. And here is 20% over and above it. So you could give it to the next of kin and everything would be squared away. But what if there's no next of kin? What if you have zero way of contacting this person that you wronged, and therefore you also have zero ability to contact any of his relatives because you don't know where they went? What are you supposed to do then? Verse 8 gives the answer. If the man has no next of kin to whom restitution may be made for the wrong, the restitution for wrong shall go to he who is for the priest, in addition to the ram of atonement with which atonement is made for him. And every contribution, all the holy donations of the people of Israel, which they bring to the priest, shall be his. Each one shall keep his holy donations. Whatever anyone gives to the priest shall be his. So what we have is the ceremony that you're supposed to go through in the tabernacle when you're, as an Israeli, making things right with the Lord involved a sacrifice. And of course, the priest, the officiating priest, would get his cut of that sacrifice because that was his payment for the work that he was doing. And that's reinforced here in verses 9 and 10, that priests get paid out of the offerings that are given during the worship. Well, if you can't pay back the person his portion, you know, the 120% of the value of whatever it was that you kept or had, then just give it to the officiating priest. Just give it to the priestly people as your way of saying, this isn't mine, I shouldn't have it, I can't get it to the person it belongs to, so I'm giving it to God. I've actually used this as a principle when I had somebody come to me once in a counseling situation. They had become Christians, and they were feeling bad about having stolen things from people when they were younger, and they wanted to make it right, which I thought was fantastic. And so I said, well, is there a way that you can get that back to the people you took it from? And they said, no, we have zero ability to do that. We don't know where they went. We have no idea. We've lost contact over the years. And so my response was, well, using an Old Testament principle, you could just simply add up what it is you owe, add another 20% to it, which is the biblical principle of the Old Testament, and give that to some charitable organization, or better yet, to some church. Now, I didn't want to ask them to give it to the church that I was part of at that particular time, because that would seem very self-serving. So I basically said, why don't you give that value into the work of the Lord somewhere? And so I think that is a good use of these Old Testament principles. Numbers chapter 5, verse 11 shifts back to the topic of intermarital relationships. And it says here, he who is spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the people of Israel, if any man's wife goes astray and breaks faith with him, and if a man lies with her sexually, and it's hidden from the eyes of her husband, and she is undetected, though she has defiled herself, and there's no witness against her since she is not taken in the act. And if the spirit of jealousy comes over him, and he is jealous of his wife who has defiled herself, or if the spirit of jealousy comes over him, and he is jealous of his wife, though she has not defiled herself, then the man shall bring his wife to the priest. Now, I'm going to break in right there, and we'll get to what happens when you come to the priest in just a moment. Let's talk about the situation. This actually gives us some more light on the Jewish law regarding adultery. Adultery is only punishable by death if the couple is caught in the act. It has to be clear-cut, witnessed, no doubt about it. This is adultery. And that brings a death penalty because vows before God in the nation of Israel have been grievously violated. So that's when the adultery penalty of execution kicked in. It's one of the reasons the John chapter 8 passage is kind of ridiculous on the parts of the Jews that were trying to trap Jesus, because they only brought the woman, saying she was caught in the very act of adultery. Well, instantly you have to ask the question, well, where's the guy? If she was caught in the act, there's got to be another person involved in this. Both of them, according to Jewish law, should have been executed. Now, of course, that's not what they were up to. They were trying to trap Jesus into violating either Roman law or Jewish law. Because Jewish law said adultery should be punished by execution. And Roman law said Jewish law has to go through Roman procedures before you do any capital offense punishment. And so they were trying to get Jesus to break one or the other, get him in trouble either with the Romans or with the Jewish people. But back to this. Back to Numbers 5. Most of the time, you're not going to catch the people in act. And so the situation comes up here where the husband is just very suspicious. He's certain in his heart that his wife is cheating on him. But he doesn't have any proof, and he can't let it go. And so what can he do about it? Well, he can get God's judgment. Because remember, Israel is a theocracy. God is the king of Israel, and so you can appeal to the king, which means going to the priest. Specifically, I think here we're talking about the high priest. But bring the offering required of her, because she's going to undergo a trial before God. So part of that is bringing an offering. So she's supposed to bring a tenth of an ephah of barley flour. That's kind of the amount that you bring with other sacrifices. He, meaning the priest, shall pour no oil on it and put no frankincense on it, for it is a grain offering of jealousy, a grain offering of remembrance, bringing iniquity to remembrance. So it's just straight up grain. That's it. The priest shall put her near and set her before he who is. So God is the one who is going to judge this case. The priest shall take holy water in an earthenware vessel. This is a special type of water. It's regular water. It's just had some things added to it or a blessing done upon it to make it special. Take some of the dust that's on the floor of the tabernacle and put it in the water. So far, we've just got plain old water with a little bit of dust particles dropped into it. That's it. Nothing poisonous about this at all. The priest shall set the woman before he who is and unbind the hair of the woman's head. There's something about the hair hanging loose in certain cultures that has something to do with unfaithfulness. So I'm not sure if that's what's coming in here, but it could very well be. And then he places in her hands the grain offering of remembrance, which is the grain offering of jealousy. And in his hand, the priest shall have the water of bitterness that brings the curse. So the water that only has a little bit of dust in it right now. The priest shall make her take an oath, saying, if no man has lain with you, and if you've not turned aside to uncleanness while you were under your husband's authority, be free from this water of bitterness that brings the curse. But if you have gone astray, then you are under your husband's authority. If you've defiled yourself and some other man other than your husband has lain with you, then, and then let the priest make the woman take the oath of the curse and say to the woman, the Lord make you a curse and an oath among your people when he who is makes your thigh fall away and your body swell. So he has this woman, repeat after me, if I've cheated on my husband, may the curse of God fall on me. May bad things happen to my body. Now, I've kind of encapsulated the effect of the words here. But the wording here is spoken aloud by the woman as a vow before God. She is testifying in the court of the Lord. This testimony is then taken down in writing, that this is what she said. We haven't got to that yet, but it is all going to be written down, those exact words. So it's effectively a, it's an affidavit that she is signing her name to. And this is about the water. May this water that brings the curse pass through your bowels and make your womb swell and your thigh fall away, meaning if you are guilty. Because remember, there is no evidence here. The husband just feels like she's cheating on him. And so he brings her before God for her to swear in front of God, I'm not cheating on you. And if I have, may God do this to me. Basically, make me sterile and make my body start falling apart, have horrible things happen to it. Verse 22, may this water that brings the curse pass into your bowels and make your womb swell and your thigh fall away. And the woman shall say, Amen, Amen. And that's Hebrew for let it be that way. May it be. The priest shall write these curses in a book or a scroll and then wash them off into the water of bitterness. So this is the next thing that's added to the water. Ink. Now, what was the ink of that time made of? It was made of some sort of vegetable starch and maybe some sort of adhesive made from some animal product. It'd have to be a clean animal product. And some carbon, basically ground up charcoal. None of this is poisonous. It is plain, simple ink. And so he's going to wash the ink off the scroll into the water, shake it all together, and this is going to be the water of the test. Now, I'd have no problem drinking this because it's not going to affect me at all. It might taste nasty, and that's what it's called here, water of bitterness. But it's not going to make my stomach swell up, and it's not going to make me infertile. And it wouldn't do it to any person. Any woman. And the reason I'm making a big deal out of this is because too many people try to say that this is stacking the deck against the woman to be found guilty. And my response is, no, it's not. It is a symbolic gesture to show that if anything is happening here, it is God's judgment that's happening. It's not a human judgment. It's God's judgment. And so what happens is the priest will make the woman drink the water of bitterness that brings the curse, and the water that brings the curse shall enter into her and cause bitter pain. Again, only if she is guilty. And the priest shall take the grain offering of jealousy out of the woman's hand and shall wave the grain offering before he who is and bring it to the altar. The priest shall take the water of the grain, take the handful of the grain offering as its memorial portion, burn it on the altar. Afterwards, shall make the woman drink the water. And when she has made, when he has made her drink the water, then if, big if here, folks, if she has defiled herself and has broken faith with her husband, the water that brings the curse shall enter her and cause bitter pain. and her womb shall swell, her thigh shall fall away, and the woman shall become a curse among the people. So if God is aware that this woman is lying through her teeth, because remember, she's just taken an oath in front of God that she's not guilty. She has agreed, may these bad things happen to me if I am guilty and lying about it. And then it's been written down and she's agreed to it and is now drinking her own words. She's done all of this, which would not normally cause any distress other than the nasty taste in her mouth. And it is up to God to show that she is guilty. And if he intervenes and causes bad things to happen to her, then that is the punishment. That effectively she is done as this man's husband. He's going to be able to divorce her, by the way, based on these grounds. If she swells up and has problems immediately, we're not talking about after a period of time, we're talking about right there, then he can divorce her. And she will go out and never be able to have kids. That's what it's basically saying. She's going to be a curse for the rest of her life because of this cheating. But, verse 28, if the woman has not defiled herself and is clean, then she shall be free and shall conceive children. This is the law in cases of jealousy, where a wife, though she's under her husband's authority, goes astray and defiles herself. Or when the spirit of jealousy comes over a man, he's jealous of his wife, then he shall set the woman before he who is, and the priest shall carry out all this of the law. The man shall be free from iniquity, but the woman shall bear her iniquity. So basically, this is what happens in the case of a woman suspected of cheating. Now, if I were a priest and a woman came to me with a suspicion of her husband cheating on her, I would just simply flip the genders in this, and I would do the exact same ceremony. Now, we have no instances historically of either of those happening, but this is God's way of dealing with such jealousy. Well, we're out of time, so we'll get back into the Word tomorrow.